Hello, my name is Dan Kois, and my favorite thing is Hippos Go Berserk by Sandra Boynton.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones. Happy New Year. This is the first regular episode of 2023, and it's a really good one for you. I am talking to author, journalist, and podcaster Dan Kois from Slate.com about his new book, Vintage Contemporaries, and about the children's book, Hippos Go Berserk by Sandra Boynton. Now, I want to call out from the top, because some people will recognize this right away, but I have had it locked in my head for years that Sandra Boynton also wrote the book Llama Llama Red Pajama. And Llama Llama Red Pajama is by Anna Dudney. I'll link to it in the show notes. Not Sandra Boynton, but because I'm an aunt who's read books, but I don't buy a lot of board books or look at the author names regularly, I had conflated the two in my head because they both write books that are very fun to read out loud. So Llama Llama Red Pajama is by Anna Dudney, and we are talking about Hippos Go Berserk by Sandra Boynton. So just, I'm going to get it wrong so many times in this podcast, and probably still for the rest of my life, because once a fact is locked in wrong in my brain, it is very difficult to unlodge. So we will see what happens. I've also got for you a clip from my friend Patty Morrissey. You will remember Patty from an episode about thrifting and decluttering from last year. Patty is the friend that came when I was starting chemotherapy and helped me KonMari and just like get my house more manageable before chemotherapy started. A really dear friend. She is now managing a thrift store on Long Island, as well as running Cultivate Club and the KonMari consulting that she does and teaching with in the KonMari programs. So she does so much. But I got her clip for the best of 2022 a little late. And so we're going to kick off the episode with a clip from Patty Morrissey and then roll right into my conversation with Dan Kois. So with that, go get your bivalent booster if you haven't yet, wear your mask, wash your hands, and keep enjoying your favorite things.
Another one of my favorite things that I did this year was an experiment around eating for pleasure. So I had lost some weight and eating for me had become kind of clinical, scientific. I would eat pretty much the same thing every day. And there were definitely foods that were on the allowed and not allowed lists. And in order to shake that up and experience more joy in eating, which is important for enjoying life because we spend a lot of our time and energy preparing for meals, shopping for meals, cooking meals, eating the meal, cleaning up the meal, that maximizing pleasure in eating I thought would enhance the quality of my life. So I dedicated 30 days to simply eating for pleasure. I took myself out to solo dates at restaurants. I learned how to cook using services like Blue Apron and HelloFresh. And I really did learn how to enjoy eating in a way that wasn't self-destructive. I did not gain a bunch of weight. I did not become unhealthy, but I started to see food as a friend and a source of joy versus something to be afraid of or something that needed to be tightly managed. So if you have a complicated relationship with food, I highly recommend this really joyful, mindful exercise of approaching each meal with the intent to fully enjoy it, fully savor it, and watch what happens. All right, those are my three things that really made 2022 significant for me. Hi, my name is Patty Morrissey, and here are a few of my favorite things from 2022. The best book I read this year is Johann Hari's Lost Connections. It's all about depression and what to do about it, and it really flips the script on how people have been talking about depression up until now. And the interventions are a lot more social in nature around things that you can take action on and do. And I did experience some depression earlier this year and applied what I learned in the book and really turned things around for myself. So one of the most important books I've ever read, and definitely the most important book that I've read of this year. Another one of my favorite things from 2022 was participating in Daybreaker. Daybreaker is an early morning dance party movement. It's a sober experience. You wake up before the sun rises, not always, sometimes they meet a little bit later, and you dance in community with other people. And so whether or not there's a Daybreaker in your city, I definitely recommend seeking out sober communal activities where you can use your body and dance freely and find those safe spaces where you can be authentic and open and joyful in the company of other people. Daybreaker also has an online platform called Daybreaker Plus, which can be fun. So you could throw that on, invite some friends over, and have a little dance party in your living room.
Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and we get recommendations without using an algorithm. This week, I'm kicking off the new year with author and podcaster, journalist Dan Coyce. He has a new book called Vintage Contemporaries available on January 17th, which means you can already pre-order it. He is also one of my sister's favorite podcasters and has done a lot of advocacy around parents in rural communities getting access to Narcan and learning how to use it. And so I just wanted to shout that out at the top. Dan, how are you doing this? How are you doing this year?
So far, so good. Nothing horrible has happened yet in 2023.
Good.
I guess there's still time.
There's still time.
Yeah.
But right now we're
coasting in on the good vibes of a 60-degree January day.
Yeah, it was a very normal day driving home with my windows open yesterday through Illinois after having been negative 50 degrees.
Right.
So.
Midwestern whiplash is even better in the era of climate change.
Yeah. Yeah, it's we had delayed our family Christmas by a week because it was supposed to be, you know, 9 to 19 inches of snow, negative 50, and we got the negative 50. And so we did Christmas over New Year's, which was nice. A nice combination.
I grew up in Wisconsin, and when I married my wife, who's from Southern Maryland, I said, well, we should, you know, we should visit my parents at Christmas. And she said, sure. And then we flew there. And we, like, landed at, like, 10 at night at Mitchell Field, and we went to my mom's house. We went to bed, and then we woke up in the morning and ate breakfast and took showers, and then we walked outside, and her hair froze. And she turned to me and said, never again. And we never again have gone there in the winter. We just go to Wisconsin in the summer now.
And Wisconsin in the summer is beautiful.
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get a rich sense of the ecosystem because you are food for mosquitoes. It's glorious.
Yeah. But then the cheese curds are food for you.
The cheese curds are food for us. That's right. That's the great circle of life.
Yeah. Yeah, that may. I need to go to Mars Cheese Castle soon. I haven't been in a while.
The temple
mm-hmm.
at which we all worship.
Yes. But yeah, so Dan, I'm so happy you're here today. Tell me a little bit about your new novel, Vintage Contemporaries.
Sure. It's a comedy about broken friendships set in New York City in the 1990s and the 2000s. It follows a young woman named Emily and her close friendships with a very volatile theater director, also named Emily, and an older single mother author whose work she becomes acquainted with, and named Lucy, and then the ways that those friendships fall apart, and then the ways that they reconnect a decade and a half later.
Mm-hmm. Did you live in New York in either of those eras in the 90s or the early aughts?
I lived in New York for one summer in 1993. Mm-hmm. 1994, when I was doing summer film school at NYU, where I learned how to make movies, a skill that I then never employed in my actual life. But I lived in the living room of my friend, my best friend from high school, Heather Hacker, who I'm still friends with, who lived on 7th Street and Avenue D. Far Lower East Side, yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, pretty close to the neighborhood that a lot of this book takes place in. And one of the things that I really remember about that time is how totally clueless I was about what that neighborhood was and represented and what was going on in the neighborhood mm-hmm. at the time. There's an enormous amount of cultural and political ferment happening in the Lower East Side in the 90s around art and music and gay rights and housing advocacy. And I didn't know about any of that stuff. I just knew that we were so far away from NYU and that the grocery store across the street never had anything good. Mm-hmm. It was because it was a drugstore front, but I didn't understand that.
right.
And so I was just like, you know, I just was living my 6 weeks in New York not knowing anything. And then I look back on it and think about, you know, obviously about how privileged and dumb I was, but also about all the missed opportunities that represented. Like, I could have been living a completely different kind of life right. in New York in 1993 than the one that I did. And so I, you know, one of the reasons that I liked setting the book in that era, in the 90s, in that place, was to give this character a chance to learn and see the things that I didn't really ever learn and see, that I didn't understand till a lot later.
Yeah.
And then in the mid-2000s, my wife and I did live in New York at that time. We lived in Manhattan from 2001 to 2009, right? Basically that whole decade we lived there. We had our kids there. We eventually left, as so many New Yorkers do. Mm-hmm. Like, we're included in the cavalcade of people who leave New York that begins one of the chapters of the book, because we had 2 kids and a dog and a 2-bedroom apartment and no babysitting, and we couldn't afford it.
Yeah. I feel like 2009 is when I was like, wait, is Philadelphia the 6th borough?
Could it be the 6th borough mm-hmm. for me? We're in Arlington, Virginia, the 11th borough.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I similarly, the summer after my freshman year of college, could it have been my freshman year? Yeah, summer of 1996, I was in San Francisco for like 8 weeks for an internship, mm-hmm. lived in the Mission, worked in the Mission, I had a $2,000 stipend for the whole summer, right? Which,
so you were not getting out a lot.
I was not getting out. Yeah. I did not have a fake ID. Like, I was underage. So I just wandered around and ate ramen and like didn't even eat like Mission, didn't even go to like the taquerias and places to eat in the Mission. So I can relate to having a summer in it. And, you know, 96 was before San Francisco became just Salesforce Tower.
Right.
Like, San Francisco was still a really interesting city in the 90s. So I can appreciate having a formative college summer somewhere
where you experience exactly 1% of what the city has to offer.
Yeah. The one thing I'm happy looking back that I did do was I was there interning on a cross country bicycle ride, literally like faxing Atlas pages.
Oh, sure. To various motels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I did that summer volunteer, for Pride and like to be parade security. Mm-hmm. So I did at least once get out of my house and do something cultural.
That's a great thing to do. But also I love that you spent your summer faxing things. I feel like that's a real lost art.
Oh, yeah. We did clip art when it was still truly cutting images out of the clip art book.
You clipped the art.
Mm-hmm. We clipped the art. You Xeroxed it. You shrunk it on the Xerox. Faxing churches. It was a wild... it was a great summer with very few transferable skills.
I feel like people today definitely don't understand the power that the fax machine had. Like how loud it was and how it would overwhelm a small office whenever a fax came in.
Mm-hmm.
And how I don't know if this happened to you in any offices you ever worked in the 90s, but in my first like sort of real non-retail job, somehow we had just ended up on a number of fax spam lists.
Yeah.
And so the fax machine would ring like 20 to 25 times in sequence. Mm-hmm. And eventually you would just take it off the hook and leave it off the hook, but you couldn't do that forever because what if an important fax came in?
Yeah.
And then we would just get like, you know, two pages of like real estate in the area or a fly by night, some kind of get rich quick scheme or something.
Yeah. Oh, in 2005, I was working at Edelman, large PR firm,
mm-hmm.
and I was an admin at the time, which meant that people on the PR teams would give me their list of fax numbers to fax. We would still, in 2005, we were still faxing some press releases.
Right.
And you'd come in the morning and you'd check the fax machine and you'd figure out like what was real and what wasn't of everything that came through on the fax at night. And it wasn't, by the time I left in 2009, I don't think anyone was faxing, I don't think we were using the fax to that level. But in 2005, it was absolutely like, Leah, here's the list of numbers, here's the press release, and you just dial. You just sit there dialing.
I know a guy who worked for Tina Brown at the height of talk,
mm-hmm.
at the peak of her powers. And she apparently, at that time at least, communicated almost exclusively by fax with her subordinates. And he lived in a tiny, tiny apartment. He was new to New York. And the only place they could put a fax machine with the right like wires and connections and phone hookup was on a small shelf over his bed.
No.
And so frequently he would wake up at 2 a.m. to a fax from Tina gently settling upon his face as it had come on the fax machine.
That's a nightmare. That is a nightmare.
Now you just get an email that makes your phone ding and wakes you mm-hmm. up, and then you're in a different kind of hell.
Yeah. Another fun, fun Edelman fact from that era was Dan Edelman, who was the founder, mm-hmm. at the time was in his 80s. He learned how to use email, sort of. But the coolest thing you could get at Edelman was a Danagram. Which was he would have his admins print out emails and he would write a response put it in interoffice mail and you would get a handwritten note from Dan on an email from you.
Oh, yeah. I worked with people who that was their only way of responding to you. I worked with people who for a long time just refused to operate email but recognize its necessity. So they would handwrite answers on email and then their assistants would have to send them back.
Yeah.
This is all – it's funny. This all seems – beside the point, but in fact is highly relevant to the subjects of this novel, which include what it's like to work in an office in the 1990s right. with a crazy person.
Uh-huh.
And then what it's like to move to a completely different way of doing work and a different way of thinking about yourself and work. The main character, you know, in the early parts of this book, she's an assistant to a literary agent in New York City. Truly not knowing what she's doing, truly just trying to keep her head above water and mm-hmm. finding herself in over her head over and over again. And then in the later part of the book, she's become somewhat accomplished. She's a senior editor at a publishing house. She has her own assistant who she tries to treat better than she was treated. She feels responsible for the place and for the for what's happening to the employees there. And she does work that she takes a lot of pride in and she also is, you know, facing a bunch of stuff that faced many of us who were in offices in the mid-2000s, from just starting to figure out how to use email to just starting to figure out what it means to have a toxic boss who treats people in a way that they ought not to be treated.
Yeah. Over the last couple of years, I have talked to a lot of authors, and I'm curious, where did COVID land for you in the writing of this book?
I started actually writing this book when I turned 40 and got very upset about how I had not written a novel despite having an ostensible graduate degree in creative writing. And COVID hit when I was 45. And so the place I was in with the novel at that exact point was that I had maybe 100 pages of sort of wildly disparate material that didn't exactly seem to have anything to, little fragments that didn't have anything to do with each other. I had spent a lot of time just writing when I could, which meant, you know, I had kids when I turned 40, my kids were 10 and 8. And that is, as many people know, that is not the most conducive time to deep thinking or immersing yourself in another world. So the writing I got done was whatever I could do at like 10:45 at night for 45 minutes out on the porch before I conked out. And so I had a bunch of these fragments that didn't make anything exactly, or I didn't understand how they made anything. And the irony for me, and many people listening, I'm sure, will find this extremely bitter to hear, but it's that COVID is the reason that the novel was able to come together. Because at that point, my kids were older and very slightly more self-sufficient. So there was a lot of bullshit about trying to get them online at school and dealing with them and navigating their days. But there still were long stretches where I actually had some time. And then my work, Slate.com, arrived upon a crackpot scheme to subvert the Washington, D.C. municipal unemployment program that was cooked up by a writer at Slate, Jordan Weissman, an economic genius, who figured out basically that if you did the paperwork just right, anyone at Slate who wanted to could just, during the height of COVID, when Slate was, I assume, hemorrhaging money.
Right.
Anyone who worked at Slate and who worked in the D.C. office could just take unemployment, which would give them about 80 to 85% of their salary. Slate would not have to pay that money. The employee would get that money, and then they could just come back whenever they wanted to. And so we basically had like a voluntary furlough program
at Slate. Right, but a paid furlough.
But a paid furlough.
Okay.
That they were like, well, if anyone wants to do this, do it. So I did it, and I helped my kids in school, and I like tried to get our house in order and tried to keep us all from getting COVID. And then I had, you know, 2 hours a day to like write. And that was the time when I basically took all those disparate fragments and said, okay, if these were a book, what would it be? And started the process of turning them from those disparate fragments into an actual story that hung together a little bit more. And so, obviously I feel fairly guilty admitting that, because that was certainly not the COVID experience that most people had. Certainly not most parents.
Right.
Definitely not most moms. But I just ended up in this unbelievably fortuitous circumstance in which, due to a bit of light legal fraud, and slightly older kids, I like managed to accomplish this thing.
Yeah.
And so I feel very grateful for that.
That's
cue the hate mail.
I don't think you're going to get a lot of hate mail. This is surprising. While it's a COVID hobby podcast for me.
It's not
number one on the COVID fraud hotline Reddit. it does not show up often on that. I don't even know if that's a subreddit, but yeah. It's coming out January 17th. How are you celebrating the launch?
Lightly. Right now I'm in the, we're recording this January 2nd. Right now I'm in the pre-publication period where I basically have gone completely insane. And I just want the stupid book to be out because, you know, I started it when I'm 40 and I just turned 48. So this thing has been in my head for a really long time in various forms. And I would just die for anyone else to read it. So I'll be really happy when it comes out. But, you know, we're still busy. We both work. I'm teaching this spring. My wife is teaching this spring. It's college hunting season. My oldest daughter is a senior. And so an enormous amount of our time is spent thinking about colleges and visiting colleges and forcing her to write 250 word mini essays that various colleges require.
It seems like now I'm a childless aunt. So like what I know is suspect, but it seems to me like the glory days of the Common App, which came after we all went to college.
Right.
But it seems like there was this window in time when it actually was a Common App. And now the colleges are all splintering off again and saying like, well, but also this and also this.
Yeah, that seems true. And now, I mean, our window is somewhat narrow in that we really only know anything about the truly enormous number of colleges that our daughter is applying to. That's also a thing now. Everyone applies to like 12 colleges.
Right.
But
because yes, they're not faxing in their applications.
Because you don't have to have access to a fax. That's what it is. Well, it's because of the Common App, but then now, but yes, there's this illusion of simplicity. And so, and really it's like, well, how hard is it really to write a 250 word piece of bullshit about how the Bates College Honors Program might benefit your life or whatever. And so they just do it. But yes, it does seem like all the colleges, it seems like colleges are just really desperate to differentiate themselves somehow in the applicants' heads, because what really matters to them is the numbers. What matters to them is like they want an enormous percentage of the people they accept to actually go to the school. And so they're marketing all the way through the process. And so for my daughter, it's been a very odd experience of really, this might be like her Gen X awakening. This is her first time of like truly having, feeling like the object of marketing and revolting against it. Because all these colleges that she has even considered, but especially the ones that she has applied to, are sending her like daily emails about, oh, what about this? What about this? Maybe you'd love this. Here's a cool thing about our school. And they will keep doing that until the second that they reject her. And then it will be like she never existed at all. But like until that moment, she is a hot property and she's not enjoying feeling like a hot property in the way that I did not enjoy, you know, like Coca-Cola thinking that they understood me at age 24 with their ads of shiny, happy people. And so maybe that's a positive in the long run. But yeah, anyways, we just have a gazillion things to do. And so I'm doing a reading in Washington, here in D.C. and on January 17th. I'm doing one in New York on the 18th. I'm doing one on the internet on the 19th. Anyone who wishes to know more about those should please just go to dancoyce.com where they're all listed handily for your perusal. And then that's it. I think that's going to be it. Like, you know, I'm doing some podcasts as with you. Hopefully they will all be as pleasant as this one. I'm writing pieces for various places because that is how you advertise a novel now. No one wants to excerpt your novel. You just have to write a piece for a magazine on a subject that is lightly touched upon in your novel. And then somewhere in the piece casually mention, as in my novel, Vintage Contemporaries.
Outstanding. Well, Dan, your novel is the reason we're talking today, but I also want to learn about your favorite things.
I have many favorite things.
Great.
As do all the people on your show, I'm sure.
Yes.
Has there ever been one person who's been like, thank God, I only have one favorite thing and no one's ever asked me about it?
I have had people say when I come up with a favorite, I've had people decline because they can't think of a favorite thing.
What?
Right. That to me is shocking. That
Oh, I'm sorry. I just don't like anything. Or is it this, oh, I love everything equally?
No, it's I don't like, there's nothing I like enough that I could talk about it for half an hour to 45 minutes. And I'm like, that's impossible.
That's completely insane.
Come info dump on me.
That's a very common 250-word college application question, by the way. What is something you could talk about unprompted for 45 minutes? It's like the tweet, what's your TED Talk?
Right.
Now colleges are using that for an application question.
But I'll say that sometimes I tell, the problem more often is that people have lots of favorites and they are worried about offending the thing they don't pick, which is not always a thing associated with a person who could get upset.
Right.
So sometimes I go with something I'm worried love. That
pears will be offended because I like apples.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what is, knowing that you have many favorites and you picked from a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. No, actually, I hate everything else. Anyone who's listening, I hate you, your book, everything you've ever done, written, sung. But I love Hippos Go Berserk by Sandra Boynton.
Oh!
This is a very short board book by the beloved New England fantasist and hippo author, Sandra Boynton. Anyone who has ever been a parent or an aunt, I'm sure, has encountered 10 trillion of Sandra Boynton's books.
Yes. Llama Llama Red Pajama, too, right?
Many classics. This is the one that had the most power in our home when my kids were little. Unexpectedly to me, as I was writing the novel, it became a recurring plot point, which gave me the occasion to repurchase the book because we had long since given away our copy to, I think, to nephews, and to revisit it and to marvel at its perfect economical storytelling and the differing life lessons that people of different ages take from this book.
So I'm curious, when's the first time you remember encountering Hippos Go Berserk?
It did not exist when I was little. It's copyright 1977, so it barely existed when I was little. By the time I was old enough, I was, by the time it probably reached Wisconsin, I was probably too old for it. So I have no memory. I have little memory of Sandra Boynton books as being part of my childhood.
Yeah.
Maybe out on the fringes. And I sort of had an ambient sense of her through the 90s. I thought of her in the same way as I thought of like B. Cliben, who drew all those cats that were on Hallmark calendars.
I know. I had that cat jigsaw puzzle.
Like the lady who drew the old lady with frizzy hair who was grumpy. I sort of thought of Sandra Boynton that way. Like she draws cute things. They're on cards and I guess books and whatnot. They don't have any correspondence with my life, so they are a part of the culture I can just completely ignore. And then we had kids, and then we immediately became desperate for books so that we could read to them. And so I don't think this is the one we were gifted. I think we were gifted a different Sandra Boynton book early in my older daughter's life, but eventually we came around to this one, and it just really hit. It became the book that Lyra, my older daughter, wanted to hear every night for several months. So it was, you know, as a regular in the rotation. And so I, you know, it's pretty early in my interaction with it, I had it completely memorized. It's not a long book. And so I could and often did read it in my sleep. and it sort of imprinted itself on my brain. And so even years later, writing this novel, when I was sort of searching for, at a later point in the story, the main character has kids, and I was searching for a book that she, that would be meaningful to her and her toddler, and Hippos Go Berserk seemed like the obvious one to go to. And then when I revisited it, I just, first of all, it was like it had been encoded in my DNA. As soon as I fell back into it, I was like, oh, I can't wait for what happens when the three hippos show up. and also, reading it in a state of consciousness, as opposed to how I was usually reading it when I had a toddler, allowed me fresh access to its genius.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't. Do you know Hippos Go Berserk? Have you read this particular one?
I read it when Henry, my sister's oldest, when Henry and Quinn were little. But I don't remember.
I'll tell you a little bit about it.
Yes.
So, and your listeners, perhaps, if they are not familiar. So, it's a story about a hippo, one hippo, all alone, who just wants to have some fun with some other hippos. So he calls two hippos on the phone. And then all of a sudden there's three hippos at the door who bring along another four. Then five hippos come overdressed to see how overdressed they are. Isn't that funny? They're all wearing suits. One of them has a cape. Six hippos show up with a guest. It's just some like little monster. I don't even know what he is, but it's six hippos with a guest. He's, I don't know if you noticed, but the hippo has Whistler's mother on his wall, but it's a hippo. Seven hippos arrive in a sack. It's just a big sack full of hippos. Eight hippos sneak in the back. Nine hippos come to work. It's the hippo staff. It's like the party down.
Oh, and their little
hippos. Yeah, and their little amazing outfits. And then after the nine hippos come to work, all the hippos go berserk. It's an enormous hippo party. All through the hippo night, hippos play with great delight. There's an incredible picture of the house just completely full to overflowing with hippos. Hippos on the roof, hippos hanging out of windows, hippos on the porch, hippos everywhere, just partying like no one has ever partied before. But then at the hippo break of day, the hippos all must go away. So then nine hippos and a beast join eight hippos riding east, while seven hippos moving west leave six hippos quite distressed. They're crying. That's what I, now that I just said that, I remember that Lyra would always point to that page and say, they're crying. Thank you.
Aww.
Your emotional astuteness was off the charts. Five hippos then set forth with four hippos heading north. And the original hippo, you see her waving to the hippos. Goodbye. Thank you for coming to my party. Three hippos say good day. The last two hippos go their way. And one hippo, alone once more, misses the other 44. That's it. That's the book. That's the story of Hippos Go Berserk.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself attracted to this story now for a number of reasons. One is it's full of visual whimsy. That Whistler's mother, that's a hippo. The house full of hippos, the various funny and absurd ways that the hippos go their various ways. Like the hippos mostly showed up
in
taxis and on foot, but then they're leaving by helicopter and on a Greyhound bus line, except for it's called Grey Hip. and in a wheelbarrow that one of them got somehow. I feel like a hippo in a wheelbarrow actually would be quite heavy and difficult to push. So I love that, and that, you know, that made it fun to read. There were always little things to point out and for a child to notice, like how the hippos are crying. But I also like that it is a children's book that is not interested in any way in explaining itself, in making the result of the book feel okay, or in soothing a person who might be upset. Instead, it simply recognizes the loneliness that the hippo feels at the beginning. It recognizes the joy of everyone coming over and how much fun that is and how great it makes you feel. And then it recognizes the sadness of when everyone leaves and you just wish people were there again. It's not a book for loners. You know, it's if you are a person who posts things on Facebook about how you are an introvert and you live an introvert's life and you have these seven major characteristics of introverts, this is not necessarily a book you will relate to. But for those of us who thrive on being with people who want that in our lives, this is a potent emotional map of how it feels when you finally succeed in getting people to do things with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all leave and you have to face once again a table and a telephone and the fact that you miss all 44 other hippos who were just at your house.
Yeah.
And so I like that about it, but as I was writing about it, I realized that that's not the only way to think about this story. I think that's the grown-up's way to think about that story.
Mm-hmm.
That it's, you think of it in terms of like Aristotelian rising and falling action. All the hippos come and then there's a climax and then all the hippos go.
Right. It's
very neat and compact. And in that way feels like an elegant and simple story. But I don't think that kids necessarily think of it that way, because kids don't experience books as always, at least my little kids, didn't experience books as discrete individual objects. They experience them as things that they heard every single day over and over and over again, so that the story patterns in them existed as part of a kind of cycle. So to me, Hippos Go Berserk looks like this. It's a single wave that goes up and then goes down. But to my daughter, I think at age 3 or 4, when I was reading it to her, Hippos Go Berserk was a continuous wave of hippos coming and hippos going.
Mm-hmm.
Every night, hippos would come and hippos would go. And you knew at the bottom of the trough that tomorrow the hippos would come again.
Yeah.
And then the hippos would go again. And it feels instead a little bit like life, like the way that life just keeps repeating. And when you're a 3 or 4 year old, the rituals of every day mean a lot to you and you depend on them. And one of those rituals is that hippos come and then hippos go. That's just the way things are. And it's not really worth making that big of a deal about it.
Hmm. That's much more than I ever thought about the book.
Certainly really, when I was reading it to a 3-year-old, I didn't think about it that much.
Because when I think about it as an adult looking at it, because I would say I am an introvert, but a couple times a year, I throw a huge party.
Right.
I have a Hanukkah party that is massive. My last time was last year, the weather, and I think we were between Delta and Omicron, we were in this dip.
Mm-hmm.
And I borrowed a fire pit, so I had 2 fire pits in my backyard. So it was an outdoor Hanukkah party, backyard party. It was like 30 or 40 degrees, so it was chilly, but the fires did their job. And I, as a host, love the feeling of the house filling up with people. And then there is that true loneliness when everybody leaves.
Yeah.
So it makes me think of that, of what it feels like to host parties. And I really, it's something I really miss. I didn't have it this year. It did not feel safe to have. 1, it was too cold. 2, it was Christmas, was the Saturday of Hanukkah. So that didn't really work.
3, everyone was sick.
Everyone was sick.
Every single person in America was sick.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it also makes me think of every house party scene from a teenage comedy.
Yeah.
Right?
That's basically what, I mean, you don't see a keg.
Right.
But that's basically what the hippos are having, the kind of totally unraveled, unhinged, wild thing that signifies to kids, adults having fun, when in fact it's very rare for adults to engage in that kind of behavior, in my experience.
Yeah.
But it's alluring, I think, the idea of just cutting loose, going truly berserk.
Yeah.
In a way that is safe and fun and harms no one, but is instead just an evening to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Sandra Boynton is, I find her an interesting character, and I had high hopes of at some point writing a profile of her, but then it turned out a great profile of her had already been written not too long ago. So the world does not probably need my version of that great profile, but, you know, she just lives in a barn, you know, like, I'm sure a very nicely refurbished barn in New England. She doesn't appear to have an agent or a publicist. She just has her own website with a little like button on it that's like, contact me. And she just like puts these books out whenever she wants. She's constantly making new stuff, new calendars or new cards or new books, or she writes, sometimes she writes musicals. And I'd forgotten that her first sort of major success was in fact in the greeting card world. So, you know, my sort of vague memory of her as Hallmark adjacent was not wrong.
Yeah.
She first became famous for, I think, for a 1975, card that I distinctly remember getting on multiple occasions for various birthdays, which says hippo birdie to use. And it's a picture of a hippo and then a bird and then two female sheep. Then it says hippo birdie to use.
To use.
Hippo birdie deer you. So then all of a sudden there's a deer. Hippo birdie to use. That's it. That's the whole card. And according to her website, that card has been redrawn 5 times and has sold 10 million copies of this greeting card. And so the idea of someone making a tiny work of art, which is, you know, simple but also whimsical and not unclever.
Right.
That then 10 million people have spent money on and given to someone they at least like.
Yeah.
Is incredible to me. And then starting in 1977, she started doing books. And in fact, Hippos Go Berserk is the first book she ever published. Her first children's book. She was a student at the Yale School of Drama at the time. Another thing I did not know about her is that she was a theater person. Although you do see a lot of drama in the interactions between her characters. And in fact, if you look at the Hippos Go Berserk party, it does sort of maybe seem like an undergraduate theater party.
Right.
Or at least the party that undergraduates in theater wish that they could have. If like,
for example, I went to a school. My undergrad had a big theater department, and I can say those parties really happened.
Oh, wow. Our theater parties didn't have staff. Although we did, the theater students did often work as staff at other people's nicer parties. Like the 9 hippos who come to work.
Yes.
Also,
we did not have staff at our theater.
Yeah. But they were big and wild. Ours were like biggish and wildish. But certainly no one had a house this nice. And we didn't have like food. It was just you had big plastic bottles of vodka.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of sexual repression. And then they combined in various interesting ways.
Yep.
She I think was 20 when she wrote Hippos Go Berserk. I don't know what her connection to children was at that point, whether she had, you know, nieces or nephews or little siblings that she was writing for, but it's like perfectly in tune with what children want out of an experience.
Yeah.
And from there her career has just blossomed. Although of course, even before she wrote the book, her career was already blossoming. She already written Hippo Birdie to Use. And so she just has just kept on working since then. She seems to just only do what she wants to do. Funded by the forever income of Hippo Birdie to Use and her other bazillion successful greeting cards and now bazillion successful books. She just like writes what is fun to her. She writes songs and records them. She like hires a band to record the songs with her. She just seems to have a great life based entirely on whimsy. I emailed with her a little bit when I was trying to maybe make a profile happen before I discovered this other profile, which she, in her kindness, pointed out to me. She was like, someone wrote a profile of me like 3 years ago. She was so nice in her emails. She was game for whatever. I was like, could I come up and hang out with you in your barn for a couple days? And she was like, sure, no problem. And it seems like the perfect, exact right level of fame, mm-hmm. in a way where you're insanely rich, presumably.
She must be.
Right. But hardly anyone knows what you look like.
Yeah.
And the only people who are really obsessed with you are too young to have driver's licenses. Mm-hmm. So they probably can't hassle you that much.
Right.
Being a hero to kids seems truly ideal. Because even if one of them kids, does that's find you.
Not a TV hero, right?
Right, right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And even if a kid does encounter you, all you're going to experience is like 5 minutes of wholehearted love. Mm-hmm. Not any kind of creepy or angry or rage-filled, adult style star encounter.
Yeah. Maybe some clarifying questions about, do the hippos live in your barn with you? What about the llamas? Mm-hmm. What animals have you met in real life? Mm-hmm. I could see some of those line of questioning.
Right, but I bet she's got answers. I bet she's ready.
I'm sure.
She's ready for all of those. Right, what, do you own a blue hat and a green hat? But yeah, I just think it seems like an impossible to attain, but nevertheless admirable kind of artistic life, mm-hmm. In which you follow your own particular muse, and it just so happens that a particular segment of the population finds it irresistible.
Yeah.
And then also you can write things that, despite their apparent simplicity, contain within them to a person who is interested enough, deep wells of surprise and interest. So that mm-hmm. when I, for example, revisited this book 15 years after reading it to my kids, it had not only the nostalgic, sentimental appeal, the mm-hmm. appeal that all those books from that era have to all of us, who once were dealing with kids on a regular basis, whether we are parents or aunts or uncles or babysitters or whoever, but also a very specific set of meanings that are fun to tease out. And it seems like there are a lot of hidden depths in her works. And maybe I'm just the kind of person who loves finding hidden depths in all simple works and overreading anything that's put in front of me. But luckily I wrote a novel about people who also enjoy overreading anything that's put in front of them. So it gave me a lot of grist for the mill.
But it is, I never would have thought about how it doesn't end with a postscript about.
Don't worry, the hippos came back. House.
No, I was thinking like about cleaning up after the party, about they broke things, but your parents won't be mad at you. Mm-hmm. Because, we read a lot of like Berenstain Bears when we were kids. They were front and center, and those always had a moral. There was always like
consequences.
Mm-hmm. And it had never occurred to me that this is not, her books are not books about consequences or
morals at all.
Morals at all, right.
Right. They might accidentally teach something. Mm-hmm. Like this book is theoretically a counting book. So it teaches kids 1 to 9 and then 9 back to 1, I guess.
Yeah. And then she does clarify at the end, it was 44 total.
It was 44. So there's some addition there if you wish to invest at a deeper level. Mm-hmm. But no, yes, there's nothing interrogating these feelings. There's mm-hmm. nothing about the ramifications of these actions. There's nothing even really about politeness. Like there's not a scene where all the hippos thank her for the nice party that she threw. Mm-hmm. Or where she thanks her guests for attending. Instead, it's just an experience that you live through, much like life,
mm-hmm.
Which also has no moral, of course. And I like that about this book. And maybe that's the differentiator for me as an adult reader, that I maybe when I was reading to a 4-year-old, I would sometimes be interested in morals. Like, I guess theoretically a moral education is part of what I'm trying to deliver to these children, and if there's a book that can provide a shortcut to that, great. Now I'm wholly uninterested in morals. They really turn me off. And so a book like this is maybe the kind of children's book I'm most likely to be able to return to and find valuable or interrogable in this way.
Is this a book that is, when you are invited to baby showers and book showers, is this number one on your give list?
Yes, this is the board book that I always give to new parents. Although, no, that's not true, actually. I give the book to kids when they're like 3 or 4 on birthdays. Mm-hmm. I have a standard baby gift that I give to all parents, and I have since we had kids, which is when you have a baby in a hospital, you'd notice that the nurses have access to these miraculous large blue pieces of absorbent paper called chucks. They're like a medical thing that you put
like
under
the puppy pads.
Yeah, like puppy pads, but basically a medical supply that, you know, if you're having surgery and you're going to bleed everywhere, they'll put a chuck under you. Or if you're having a baby and you're going to leak in various ways, they put a chuck under you. And when we were, you know, changing our babies very early in their lives, those first 2 days in the hospital, there was just a pile of chucks in our room. And we would take one and put it under the baby and change the baby. Mm-hmm. It was incredible because whenever you change a baby, as soon as you take their diaper off, they instantly pee everywhere. And so I discovered that you can order chucks online from an online incontinence supply company.
Okay.
And so I order 250 chucks from this incontinence supply company and send them as gifts to anyone who's had a new baby.
That's brilliant.
And thus putting them on an incontinence mailing list for the rest of their lives, something that will be inevitably useful to them in their advanced age.
Yes.
And it's great. I love giving that gift to new parents. But yes, once a kid is old enough to be given their own books, this is a regular in our roster of books that we give to small children.
Nice. I was feeling pretty good about this, like the swaddles I usually give people, but
great gift.
Yeah, the Aiden and Anise, the big muslin swaddles. Mm-hmm. But Chuck's is a good one.
Well, if anyone wants to follow my lead, please feel free. The incontinence supply care company is called North Shore Supply. They're great. They've been very nice to me over the years. There's even a little thing, a box on their order page that I believe is for messages like, leave on porch, dog is vicious. But I use to say, please put a message in here that says, congratulations, this is for your baby to pee on. Love, Dan.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's just such a good gift idea.
It's a good gift, and it's nice to have a signature gift. I find that important in life.
It's also nice to, signature gifts help you cut down on decision fatigue.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I never have to be like, well, what do I think this baby would like? Because babies don't like anything. Mm-hmm. I just know. I know a thing that will be useful to their parents, and I've gotten good reviews on that gift. I don't know, maybe some parent is like, oh, my God, I can't believe he sent us chucks again. But I think most parents enjoy having a thing to put their baby on to change them so they don't pee on the couch.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're walking around with that foam changing pad and just moving it around the house.
And then washing it. And it never really gets clean.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if you're a cloth diaper family, chucks are not the product for you because it's just a disposable thing that's going in a landfill. But if you are a disposable diaper family, chucks might be the way to go.
Yeah. Outstanding. Is there anything else about Hippos Go Berserk or Sandra Boynton or board books that I haven't asked you about yet that you wanted to make sure you said?
No, I'm curious. You said, you know, Blue Hat, Green Hat.
I know Llama Llama Red Pajama.
Llama Llama Red Pajama.
Yep.
I remember our other favorites were Moo Ba La La La, which is just a collection of animal sounds, basically, that rhyme.
Yeah.
And But Not the Hippopotamus, which, as I recall, it might be the same hippopotamus as the hippopotamus in Hippos Go Berserk, but it's about a hippopotamus who is not included in things
Oh, no.
And then maybe at the end is included in things. I don't know. It's all very foggy. I might need to repurchase this and revisit it. All I know is that it has a constant refrain, which is that other things are doing things, but not the hippopotamus. Maybe it's about an introvert. I don't know. Surely I'll encounter it someday soon and find deep riches of meaning deep in the well of this otherwise shallow seeming book.
I'm scrolling through her author page now. There's so much that I didn't know.
She produces.
She really does.
She seems driven by demons beyond our comprehension to produce on a yearly basis adorable books that you'd love to page them. Plus, she does some things for adults, which I have never found that enjoyable, like Chocolate, the Consuming Passion, which was like a book that boring adults always gave each other for when they didn't actually like each other or know anything about each other in 1985.
Okay.
But the kids' books, magic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She's got a bunch of calendars. It's interesting that it's never been animated. Like she, to my knowledge, which is limited.
I've never seen one. Maybe something's living on YouTube. But yeah, you could make a great 2.5 minute movie out of Hippo's Go Berserk. I'm now trying to imagine, like, if Illumination Entertainment, the people who do Minions, got a hold of the Sandra Boynton catalog and, like, the story-breaking sessions they would have to go through to expand the Hippoverse into, like, a three-beat Hollywood story. And, like, the main hippo would have a whole backstory, and then there would be a bunch of side stories with the other hippos who come to the party. Then the party itself would be like a 15-minute action sequence to the tune of like Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba. And then the end of Act 2 would be that all the hippos have left and the hippo is sad. And then Act 3 would be an incredible journey she goes on to find all the other hippos who are somehow in peril on their various journeys home. And then they all collect up together and have one final throwdown and then move into a big house together.
I mean, there's the pitch.
I guess that's it. That's but
Hollywood.
But what a terrible movie that would be. I wouldn't want to watch that at all.
I think her stuff would work well if you think about how Garfield was as a Saturday morning cartoon, because it was split between Garfield and like the farm, like it was half Garfield and half the farm animals Garfield came from.
That turned into U.S. Acres, his failed second comic strip.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it worked as an animated show.
Right.
So I think 15-minute vignettes.
Right. I mean, the version of it that works best is for 3 or 4 year olds. And so
like,
YouTube videos that are basically just long enough for dad to say, take a shower, seem like the exact right mode for this. But, you know, bless her that apparently she's never done it. She doesn't need that money.
Yeah.
She doesn't need the hassle.
She's got her. Maybe I'm going to go to YouTube
and discover that, in fact, there's a Sandra Boynton channel with 7 trillion subscribers and all the videos are AI generated like Coco Melon Nightmares. But my hope is that it doesn't seem like her vibe.
It doesn't seem. I agree.
No,
I agree.
She's just up in her barn making stuff. She doesn't need to deal with Hollywood.
Wonderful. Well, Dan, thank you so much for kicking off the year with me.
Thanks. It was a great pleasure.
Vintage Contemporaries. People can pre-order it now. I'll put the link to bookshop.org, and it's available January 17th. Go to dancoyce.com to look for the virtual event or the DC or New York event if you happen to be in those places.
And thank you for mentioning Bookshop. Yes, please. If you order it from there or from your local indie. If you have an indie that you love, there's also a link on the website to order signed copies from my local indie here in Arlington, Virginia. If for some reason my totally horrible signature is of interest to you, but I will happily personalize it with any obscene message you want. And also, if you're interested in reading it, you can and should request it from your local library, which depends frequently on readers like you telling them what you want to read in order to order those books. And I would love for this book to live in libraries all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Do you have plans for an audiobook?
There is an audiobook.
Outstanding.
It is. I read my previous audiobook, which was a memoir, so it made sense for me to read it.
Mm-hmm.
This book is from the perspective of a number of women, so it did not make sense for me to read it. But I have a wonderful reader who did a great job based only on her own natural talent and experience and the one note I gave her beforehand, which was none of these characters really get that upset about anything. So, like, don't go overwrought. So she, mm-hmm. she kept a very dry humor throughout the whole thing, which delighted me.
Nice. Where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Slate.com, my magazine home for 11 years now, where I write and edit all the time. And I'm on Twitter at Dan Coyce, and I'm at DanCoyce.com.
Outstanding. Well, Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Leah. This was fun.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.